This is an interview with Governor Attia. This is tape 8, side 2. You were talking about Walter Pearson.
Yeah, Walter was what you'd call a big shot. He'd been Senate president. And he would say, this is what we're going to do. This is what's going to happen. And I said earlier in the tape that as a House member, I got the news finally by saying, how can one man tell us, all of us, what we're going to do? And of course, this was a real David and Goliath kind of thing, you know, because Walter was just a big shot, senior, had been there a long time and all the rest of it. We dealt with some pretty interesting people in the Senate. The Senate kind of had held on. We already talked about Harry Boyven, and you've got Tony Ituri, your leader, and Walter Pearson, and Tom Mahoney, and you know, these are all kind of crusty old timers. Talk about a old boys club, you know, they really had this thing pretty well wired.
And what impressed you most about them, about their ability to get things done, or how they organized
things? No, I wasn't
things?
Particularly impressed with them. I was never one that believed in twisted arms, so I didn't care for that kind of thing. I wasn't intimidated by anybody. In other words, I didn't mind debating or arguing with any of them. I guess I'm dealing with personalities. I like some. I just thought others were adequate, and I didn't really dislike anybody.
You were also on the education committee.
Yeah.
And Al Flagle was the chair of that, and Corbett was vice chair, and Don Husband was also on that. Monahan, and Ben Musa, Leth.
Walter Leth.
Walter Leth. I don't know anything about him. What can you tell me?
Walter, he's from Polk County. I was mistaken when I mentioned about Eddie Arendt in agriculture. It was Walter Leth that was the agriculture guy. He was director of ag after he left office, Walter Leth. So I was mistaken about Eddie Arendt. Walter Leth was I don't know how to put it. He was one of the voices that people heard. He was not one of the leaders. Now, when we talk about Leth and some of the others, we're talking about Republicans and the Democrats controlled. Incidentally, I did something then that came back to haunt me later on, although if I had a choice to do it over again, I'd do it. But I didn't believe in a coalition. Mm-hmm. And that's what was going on when I got to the Senate. Coalition meaning that the Republicans and a few Democrats would decide who was going to be the presiding officer. And we had enough Republicans, so we only needed just a few Democrats. On the coalition side, I'm sure it was Harry Boyven and Walter Pearson and Mahoney and some of the other folks. They were on there. But I didn't agree. I didn't believe in a coalition and voted against it in my own caucus. And a few sessions later, they got me for that.
Who did?
The coalition. I mean, some of the, you know, it didn't all add up. It's actually my own caucus. I'm trying to remember when I finally ran for and was elected the Senate leader. Mm-hmm. And in those days, it was a kind of a pro forma thing. By that I mean the Republicans would put up their nominee, but they already knew it was going to be a Democrat.
Yeah.
And I was voted in as the Republican leader of the Senate. But we took a vote as to what names we were going to put up. This was the John Burns period of time.
Right.
And my name was never, not once. I'm the Senate Republican leader, and not once did they put up my name. Hmm. Not one time.
And that was because of the coalition?
And I'm sure that's exactly, nobody ever said anything, but I didn't, you know, we go into this joint caucus thing, before the session starts, just to kind of get the lay of the land. And it's kind of embarrassing to to be the Senate Republican leader and your name is not brought up.
Hmm. Why were you against the coalition?
I always believe that it has to be somebody responsible. And I don't mean somebody. In this sense, the Democrats controlled, and I think that they should be responsible for whatever happened. Mm-hmm. Take credit or criticism, but it's the Democrats. When you have a coalition, you can't really do that. Mm-hmm. There's no way to say, well, the Democrats did such and such, because obviously the Republicans were a party to the organization of the body.
Mm-hmm.
That's fundamental. It's a philosophical thing with me. Some are less, more pragmatic and less philosophical. They say, look, if we don't do this, we're going to have all those liberals in the Senate, a la Halleck and Wilner and those folks. They're going to run the show, and we can't have that. And I suppose they've got a point. But I was sticking to my philosophy.
Uh-huh. Do you recall specific instances where you actually voted against the coalition?
No, other than for the presiding officer.
Were there times when you were also voting for the coalition as well?
I'm sure, but at that point, it didn't make a difference. This was the organization.
Yeah.
Who's going to be Senate President? And then out of that, who's going to get the chairmanships?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of Republicans got some very important chairmanships.
Mm-hmm.
The Newbery Chairman of Ways and Means, Tony Turi, Chairman of Judiciary, you know, those kinds of things.
Right.
That's where all that came from.
Yeah. Yeah. Why didn't the Democrats ever form some kind of a coalition, or maybe they didn't have to because they were in the majority, but why weren't they as tight as the Republicans were?
Well, there was really kind of a split, and I have trouble with, I'd have to sit down and figure it out, but there was a body of senators that were liberal, mostly from Multnomah County, and then there were the conservatives, I'm talking about Democrats now. They just didn't. They didn't want to see the legislature or Senate run by these guys. So actually, they were, meaning the Democrats, because it has to be a Democrat that agrees.
Yeah.
To take the support of all the Republicans. They have to agree to do that. And they probably didn't have enough votes within the liberal side to get elected as a presiding officer. So they come over to the Republicans, and I'm sure it didn't take this formality, but okay, you guys vote for me and I'll run.
Right. Right. Did you see trade-offs happening for votes on that?
Oh, I've never seen them, but I know they're there. You know, you tell by the way people vote. And on some things it just didn't make any sense at all. But I've never been a witness. I can't tell you so-and-so did that on a certain day. I've just never been a witness. You just know. You can tell.
Why wasn't there ever a situation in which the coalition actually put up somebody from the minority party in the case, say, where Boivin or Potts would be elected president of the Senate? Maybe why wouldn't, say, Newbery or yourself have been elected, even though you were technically in the minority with the coalition?
Well, the Republicans wanted the liberals even less than the Democrats did, and so the Democrats obviously had a hammer. Look, if you just guys don't do this, you know, we're just gonna go off on our own and have our own caucus. The Democrats will elect the liberals, and I think that was kind of a hammer they held on.
Did your office space or secretary change once you went over to the Senate? You were still out on the floor, isn't that right?
Yeah, we really didn't get any offices until wings were built.
And did your secretary come over with you
from
the House?
Yeah.
So that stayed the same as well. Did your wife ever work for you?
No.
She had a family to raise. You've mentioned some of the Democratic and Republican leaders at the time, Boivin and Potts and Republican leaders like Uteri and Newbery. Were there others that actually stood out that we haven't talked about?
Well, again, Flagle, and you mentioned Flagle. We really didn't talk too much about Potts, but Potts obviously was a Senate president, and He was quite influential in a very, very quiet way. Very quiet way. Mm. And that's, I have to incidentally say, there was always, you know, in spite of that you wouldn't want it, there still was a downstate, upstate contest. Mm-hmm. And if you look at speakers and presidents over a period of time, you rarely see, as we do in Vera Katz, for example, someone from the metropolitan area as a speaker or president. Mm-hmm. Has happened, but if you took it in bulk, at least through the period of time that I've been involved, it was always the downstates.
And is that because of a group binding together to keep someone from the metropolitan area taking over?
I think so. But see, because I wasn't, certainly in the House, I was never a part of it because I was never a majority member. And then when I get to the Senate, I wasn't coalition supporter, so they never really took me into their confidence as to how they're working all this out.
Well, you were on the Education Committee, and one of the things that came up during that session was that the increased basic school support and aid for higher education and community colleges passed. Was there any change in the formula by which the state was figuring these out?
No, and I say that not from only the memory that I can recall going through hours and hours mm-hmm. of computer runs trying to change the formula, and I've seen it all laid out, and we've gone about it rather scientifically, you know, how we're going to make these changes. That after all of this very high level discussion, and then you'd get a run on it. Okay, now what's it going to look like? Right. First thing you do is you turn to your own county, your own district. So you go mm-hmm. through all of this very philosophical discussion, but when it finally comes down to it, the philosophy's out the window. What's it going to do to Washington County, School District 48? You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And so,
how would you find that out?
They would, you know, you get the printouts. Uh-huh. See, okay, if you make this change, this is what is going to happen. Well, we wasted a lot of paper on a deal like that. So when you talk about change, I did mention to you earlier, and it was that committee, that session, that they were trying to get basic school support for the trainable mentally retarded. Mm-hmm. And I'd asked the question, is this the best way to do that? And no answer gave me the answer. Mm-hmm. And I felt kind of bad about it because you know, I can recall mother talking about sending her children off to school, one of whom was a trainable, and the trainable would stay at home watching mm-hmm. Their siblings go to school, and it was rather touching, it was to me. And here I was really preventing anything from happening. But as a result, as I told you, we had a study on it in the interim, and then the next session passed a bill, and I thought it was very good, and it was good that you waited, but it was kind of tough. To go through that, knowing you say, okay, telling the mother, wait two more years. It's not easy to do. Not easy to do. But it was that committee, that session.
There was a failure to merge the state departments of higher education, state departments of education and higher education.
Yeah.
What was the issue there that prevented
that? Well, it's just the super board. Uh-huh. That was the term that was used at that time. Right. And it'll get too big, that's all. Mm-hmm. And the interests of higher education and primary and secondary, by and large, were different. Mm-hmm. The interest of higher education, of course, was to get not only students, but to get students that were prepared to go to college. Mm-hmm. And we really didn't achieve that. We achieved it when I was governor indirectly. And by that I mean we just erased the standards for entrance into the colleges. Mm-hmm. And then that had to bring up, you know, if somebody's going to go to college, they had to have a higher achievement. So that backed it off into there. But really, super board was just something getting too big. Mm. That was Stafford Hansel. Stafford Hansel was big on that super board, but it never prevailed.
You know, one issue going through the newspaper clippings that I saw over and over and over again was this fight to repeal the 1913 law requiring a six-man crew on freight trains. Could you give me a little background on that? And
I'm laughing because this was a feather bedding deal. This was the second brake man. I think that's what it was. Anyway, this was the only time in my whole career that somebody said to me, "We're going outside and fight." This was a railroad union guy.
You mean literally?
Literally. Yeah, he wanted to go fight. He wanted to beat me up. I said, "Well, I'm not going to go outside with you." And it got real heated. Again, let's talk about principle. And part of the problems incident I had when I was on the labor committee and all the bills are coming up, and I said to myself and told my friends in labor, "Look, guys, you believe in collective bargaining. Collective bargain this. Mm-hmm. You don't come to the legislature to collective bargain in the Oregon State Legislature. You collective bargain out there." That was my position, and that labor didn't like that. They liked to do their collective bargaining in the legislature. They didn't have to go through all this other mess with the employer. But this was feather bedding on the railroads. Mm-hmm. There was feather bedding on the railroad. There was. Mm-hmm. And there just wasn't any need for the crews that they had.
Did this come up in your labor committee? Was that where it occurred?
I can't recall. I don't recall that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where it came from. It may have come from state, federal. I don't know where the bill came from, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But I do remember vividly, and there was no question as to where I was going to go. But I can even remember, like almost a photograph, we're standing in the doorway of the Senate where this guy challenged me to go outside. He wanted to beat me up. Hey, I ain't going out with you. So we never did go out and fight.
Didn't the sergeant of arms try to intervene? Or?
Well, he didn't get that far. He was just real angry, and he wanted to take me up and beat me up, and I said, "I wasn't going to have any part of it."
There was legislation for compulsory breath tests for blood alcohol content of persons arrested for drunken driving. Do you recall the debate on that?
I don't recall the debate on it, but I do recall debates on the issue. Mm-hmm. And first of all, it begins with my very strong feeling, which persisted all the way through my career, mm-hmm. about the drunken driver, and they have no right to be on the highway. And I tried in many ways to get laws changed, to stiffen the laws on drinking drivers. And so I can only talk to you about generically and not mm-hmm. specifically. And there were the lawyers, you know, go to court on this breath test thing. It depended on when it was it going up or was it coming down, and whether or not the test was a good test or not. And I was really angry about it because there's no doubt the guy was drunk. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they could use all these fine points to get the guy off the hook. So I can't give you specific answers. I can just tell you. Of course, I was kidding, but I can recall early, it was the next session, I think I was on the Transportation Committee one time, and one of the people from the Department of Transportation came over and didn't quite know where I stood in terms of traffic safety and drunken driver. And I said, I'll tell you, let me put it this way. I said, I'm for capital punishment in this case. Now, I'll be glad to negotiate with you anywhere up and down that line. I was just trying to emphasize, obviously, I'm not talking about it. I was just trying to emphasize how strongly I felt about it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any long conversations with Lee Johnson on this?
No.
He was your assistant and
yeah.
was attorney general. And
yeah.
And... he was in the Senate. Was he in the Senate at the same time that you were? I guess he was, but maybe later on.
I don't think he ever got to the Senate. I think he was always in the House.
He was in the House. Did he go straight from the House then to the Attorney General?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, well, you know, there's always these lawyers. First of all, I will say this. I don't know how you want to call them, whether you call them plaintiff's attorneys or defense attorneys or whatever. Mm-hmm. They have actually, what's the word I want to use? They have prevented, they tied up the Oregon legislature for my entire career and will not permit anything that would really close a even a legitimate loophole that they've been using. And I really dislike them. When I say dislike them, obviously I'm not talking about any one person because I'm not appointing them. But I think that they prevented, they've been more to be criticized for the thing that people say, and it's true. There's a greater concern for the criminal than there is for the person against whom the crime is committed. I believe that. I believe it. And it's still going on today. And it was going on from day one in 1959. It was going on when I left office. And there's just no way to beat those folks. They just nothing good delivered comes out of the legislature that really is helpful. Well, that's not quite right, because we were able to get some pretty significant later on traffic safety legislation passed. There I credit the Mad Mothers, because they finally got the people of Oregon to sit up and take notice that drinking and driving is just not acceptable in the state of Oregon. And until the people made that decision, we really couldn't get any bills through.
There was a new set of laws regulating the state's insurance industry. I think this was aside from workmen's compensation. But was that part of the same package, or?
I can't remember that.
Redistricting comes up all the time, and in this session, the legislature decided to leave it to the courts to decide. Is that a strictly partisan issue, redistricting?
I mean, mostly, yeah. Mostly.
It will always fall down partisan lines in a case the coalition doesn't hold.
This whole matter of gerrymandering is, you know, they say that people sit down and they figure out what the precincts are and how many Republicans and how many Democrats, and you try to squeeze them in there. And you look at some of the district lines and they take some odd twists and turns. It's everybody's jockeying for position. You can't, today you can't outrageously gerrymander. I don't know where you draw the line, but they do some as subtle gerrymandering as they can.
Why wouldn't the people forming the coalition continue in terms of redistricting?
Well, their interest was the president of the Senate and the key committee.
Right.
That's where it stopped. Then they'd go back to being Democrats again.
I guess that leads me to the other question I keep wondering is, if these people are always siding with Republicans and they're suspicious of the Multnomah County Democrats, why are they Democrats?
Because they get elected in their district.
But is it really important to the people of Klamath Falls whether Harry Boivin's a Republican or a Democrat?
No. No, that's not the case at all. Harry Boivin could change and become a Republican and get elected. That, however, doesn't mean that Joe Smith, who wants to start, who happens to be a Republican, he's got a tougher chance because there's more Democrats than Republicans down there. So it relates to the person. But, you know, you ask why. You know, they fit the district pretty well. Klamath Falls, a registered Democrat, but there's a lot, mostly conservative. That if you know, they'd be registered Democrat, but they would be considered a conservative Democrat. Probably more conservative than Republicans up in Multnomah County. No different than the Democrats down south are by far more conservative than any Democrats down there, than any Republican up here. Well, that's not quite any, but most. So, you know, it just varies and fit the district.
In your long involvement in the political process since the 50s, do you feel that political parties are becoming more or less ideologically defined? I'm thinking not only in terms of the state, but nationally as well.
Uh,
Or do you think that maybe it's just
only,
trends?
The only real issues that you even bring up the subject of abortion and homosexuals, mostly abortion. And my answer would be generally no. There's still that terrible image that Republicans are for the wealthy people and Democrats are for the common folks. I've said many, many times that Republicans have an image we don't deserve and the Democrats have one they don't deserve. And I believe that. That's from my own personal experience.
You don't really feel that there's a strong ideological pull towards one party or the other as is happening in, say, like in England with the parliamentary system there, where they have where they don't really have Republicans and Democrats, they have a liberal and a conservative party, and ideologically you go to whichever party you're most.
I don't think it's that well defined, at least my observation, because there'd be a lot of Democrats that should be registered Republicans and a lot of Republicans that should be registered Democrats, and for whatever reason they're not. And that could vary with how many other people are registered that way. And the parties really don't really prevail that strongly. The party platforms, I can't remember what year, but the Democrat platform was just outrageous as it could be. I mean, it was really liberal as it, I mean, really wildly liberal, as some perceive the Republican platform now to be wildly conservative. The candidates just turn their backs on it and go about their way running their own elections. And besides, I don't really know who reads platforms anyway.
Same session, there was pollution of rivers was banned. Was this part of an overall program for cleaning up? Pollution of rivers was banned? Was this part of like a preliminary step for the Willamette Greenway or?
Well, that may have been a beginning. When I say beginning, now we're getting into the Interim Committee on Public Health out of the 65 session. And out of that became really the beginning of our environmental program in Oregon. I can't remember that bill you're referring to, but this could be at the very beginning of all this whole process.
There was a failure to pass a merger of the Fish and Game Commissions. Why was there a reluctance to do that?
I think mostly the Fish Commission was more the commercial fishing side, and game really was not really game. Well, it was game, meaning animals, but it also was for the recreational fishermen.
It was more recreational than commercial.
So the fish side was commercial, and they certainly were. They wanted to make sure their interests were maintained, and they didn't want to be charged, which did occur from time to time, added fees to take care of the recreational side of this question.
Right.
So those were, besides protecting their own commercial side, they always had a fear that they were going to get extra fees to benefit the recreational side.
One issue that is very volatile in the Northwest that came up during this session, the legislature passed a long-range study of Oregon's water resources to head off attempts to divert the water to the Southwest. That's been a standing
That's never really gotten anywhere. The whole idea of pumping water to California, they keep talking about it, but it's never